Good morning. Welcome to Dr. Hugh Ross's Paradox of Sunday School class. Today is the 7th of January, 2024, I believe, and Happy New Year. Dr. Ross is with us today. He will be gone the next couple of weeks, but we have some fantastic speakers. Ted Bates will be talking about the rapture next week, and Dave Sargent's going to give a special Mars lecture. So he's got a lot of experience on that. Dr. Ross today will be talking about the Grand Tack. We're not talking about a sailboat either. The planets. It's going to be very interesting. And with that, I'm going to say a quick prayer and we'll get him up here. So please bow your heads. Lord God, we just ask for you to bless us with your presence now, Lord. Bless our class and the message, whatever Dr. Ross gives to us. Make it a worthy message, Lord, that we can use as our witnessing tools. Bless him and his travels, Lord, and he's going to tell us about that. In Jesus' name, amen. Come on up, Dr. Ross.
Oh, my apologies. My little microphone here was looped around a chair, and I had to completely untie it. But good to be with you. And yes, I'll be gone for two Sundays, and I'm going to be at a Bible college in Hawaii teaching an intensive class on science and faith. And it's an interesting concept. It's a little bit like LaBrie that some of you may have heard of. It's basically 40 young people, and they all live in one building, the same building where I'll be spending time. So it's kind of focus on community. It's interesting that the sermon we heard this morning was on Christian community. Well, this is kind of an intense community, and these students commit to 9 months, and they get a different professor every week. And so I'm taking a week as their professor. I have meals with them, I live with them. We even have a day where we hike all together. So looking forward to that. They also encourage us to bring our spouse along because they want people to actually see how a Christian marriage operates. And it's a time where the students get to fire questions at you literally around the clock for a 7-day period. So, and I'll also be speaking at some churches there. So that's what I'm going to be doing these next 2 weeks. And I actually know a lot of the other professors that are participating in this. The phenomenal thing that gets me is that they take care of all the room, the board, the professors, everything, travel. This all comes in at a cost of just $12,000 per student. I mean, as a parent, I don't know how I can feed my children for $12,000 a year. So I guess a lot of people are tempted, hey, I get to ship my kids off, and but they're not kids, they're young adults. So, but we're gonna be wrapping up this series on Design for Redemption. Today we're gonna be focusing on the solar system, and while I'm gone, you're gonna be able to hear from Dave Sargent about Mars. I'll briefly address what's called the small Mars problem this morning and why that's a problem. And then I'm going to wrap up with a talk about the Earth. And, you know, as I was driving over here, I was just thinking and saying, you know, we all have this bucket list of places we want to go and see. And this Earth is so beautiful that you're never going to complete your bucket list. No matter how fit you are, no matter how long you live, you just can't do it. There's just way too much there. God has created an extravagant planet for us. It's bountiful. Again, the sermon this morning, we're talking about the manna that God had provided. And if you look at the planet, it's everything we need has been provided. And so next week I'll talk about some of the provision of planet Earth that enables us to do what God wants us to do that most people have never even thought of. I mean, usually you think about, well, we got places to live, we got food. We'll be talking about some really things that even astronomers haven't really considered about the bounty of this planet. But today I want to focus on the solar system and what's so interesting about our solar system. And so I first want to explain what's referred to as the ice line. And this is a map of our solar system, and the distances are to scale, but the sizes of the planets and the sun obviously are not to scale. And the ice line is the distance from the host star where volatiles freeze. And you say, what are volatiles? Volatiles are elements and molecules, gases, elements and molecules that will freeze when you get down to temperatures that are significantly less than what we experience here on planet Earth. So, I mean, you can go to the grocery store and you can buy frozen carbon dioxide. How many of you have ever gotten dry ice, okay? And the thing about dry ice is that it evaporates at the same temperature that it liquefies. So with carbon dioxide, with dry ice, it goes from ice to vapor and bypasses the liquid form. By the way, if you go to Mars, we'll be hearing about Mars, water is like dry ice on Mars. It goes from the frozen state to the vapor state without ever going through the liquid transition. And it all has to do with the air pressure of the atmosphere. But the air pressure on planet Earth is such that dry ice will do that. And I can remember when my sons were teenagers, they would say, Dad, can you go buy us some dry ice at the grocery store? And I found out that they actually have a law here in California. No one under the age of 18 can buy dry ice. And I found out from my teenage sons why that law is in place. Because what my sons would do, they would take a little bit of dry ice, put it in a can or a bottle, put the cap on, and then stand back behind a barrier and watch the thing explode. So we had a few incidents in our backyard, and I quickly recognized, hey, I got to supervise these events, especially when there's 10 teenage boys in the backyard. You never know what they're going to do, and they think they're going to live forever, so I had to counsel them out to take appropriate, and it says, we're not using glass. That'll blow everywhere and can kill some birds, etc. So, but yes. And this ice line, it exists about a little less than halfway the distance between Mars and Jupiter. And it's at that distance where water freezes, carbon dioxide freezes, carbon monoxide freezes, ammonia freezes, and it freezes in ice grains. And this ice line explains why, when you got planets interior to the ice line, you get rocky planets. When you got planets exterior to the ice line, you get gas giants. Because once you get past the ice line, the temperature is so low that all these light molecules are frozen and they wind up being gravitationally drawn into Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. Whereas you're interior to the ice line, these things become vapor or liquid, and therefore they're not easily accreted by the rocky planets. And these rocky planets tend not to have a lot of these volatiles. Whereas Jupiter and Saturn, for example, Saturn is so loaded with volatiles, it would actually float in water. Saturn has a density that's less than that of a liquid water. And it's because Saturn is so dominated by these volatile materials. Okay, Saturn's gonna talk about the Grand Tack. And if you anything know about sailing terms, the way a sailboat is oriented is that you got special sails that you can tilt at different angles so that your sailboat can actually sail into the wind. Not directly into the wind, of course. You basically orient the sails so you kind of go this way and this way, this way and that way. And you don't go that fast, but you're actually able to sail directly against the direction of the wind just by tilting the sails. And this is a term that was applied to our solar system by a team of astronomers at Nice, France. And it's called the Nice team, or the Nice team. Yeah, I gotta remember French, right? Nice, it's the Nice team, so. And this is called the Nice model. And they began by looking at these catalogs of planets orbiting other stars. And what they noticed in those catalogs, this is something I shared last week, the vast majority of gas giant planets in other planetary systems, they're inside the ice line. And they said, why are they inside the ice line? They can't form there. And what they realized is that they do form beyond the ice line, but they wind up engaging these frozen volatiles, little bits and pieces. They're like the size of meteorites. And the gravitational interaction between these gas giants and the remaining bits of dust of these volatiles, little planetesimals, actually causes them to migrate in towards the star. And so it's the leftover remains of planet formation, gravitationally engaging with these gas giant planets, that causes them to migrate inwards. And when they run out of these little bits and pieces of meteors or asteroids and comets to gravitationally engage, they stop migrating. And so they basically come in towards the close to the star, and once all that debris is exhausted, they stop migrating. You say, what happens if they don't exhaust all that debris? They crash into the star, and the gas giant is gone. And so it explains why in some extraplanetary systems, we really don't see any gas giants. They basically all migrated inwards and collided with the star. And so just as last week we pointed out, the vast majority of Neptune-type planets, super-Earths, and gas giants, they're orbiting interior to the ice line. In fact, the majority of them are orbiting interior to the planet, the orbit of the Earth with respect to their star. So they move in to quite a degree. Now, there are cases where we see the gas giants actually more distant from their host star than what we see in our solar system. And these begin to experience, it's an exceptional engagement where instead of migrating inward, they migrate outward. It only happens when you've got gas giants that form very distantly from the stars, say out where Uranus and Neptune are, and all the stuff in interior to that's been exhausted. So typically what you're looking at are gas giants that are closer to the host star that have moved inward and wound up being absorbed into the star, and you got remaining ones, and the gas and dust there basically pushes these planets way out. But we now know that these gas giant planets tend to form where we see the gas giant planets in our solar system. It's just that they don't stay put. And then this team in Nice, France said, well, it looks like that our gas giant planets formed and didn't move. But then they began to look at what's called the small Mars problem. And the fact that we have no asteroids that are very close to us. We have a few, but when you look at, say, the main belt of asteroids, their models of planet formation showed them we should have a main belt of asteroids that goes from Jupiter all the way to Mars. Instead, it only goes halfway to Mars. And then they got what's called the small Mars problem. And this was noted by the fact that the more distant a rocky planet is from the host star during its formation stage, the greater the mass. Now, we actually see that in the case of Mercury, Venus, and Earth. Mercury is the smallest of the rocky planets. Venus is next, and Earth is next. Mars should be about twice the mass of Earth, and it's only 1/9 the mass of Earth. That's what's called the small Mars problem, that our models predict that Mars should be really big. Instead, it's quite small. And actually, that's good, especially good for us astronomers. If Mars was twice the size of Earth, it would be blazing bright in the night sky. And if it was twice the size of Earth, it would have accreted a very thick atmosphere. And if it accreted a very thick atmosphere, it would be very bright. I mean, Venus is bright. I don't know how many of you ever noticed. Venus is right there in the morning sky. But because it has an atmosphere 90 times thicker than the Earth, it's very bright. In fact, there are occasions when you can read a newspaper by the light of Venus. It only happens around about 4 in the morning in certain times. When it's an evening star, it's quite a bit dimmer than when it's a morning star. So yeah, you might want to sometime get up at 4 a.m. and see if you can read a newspaper by the light of Venus. So people used to do that. Okay, but there'd be another problem. If Venus was twice the mass of our planet Earth, it would gravitationally distort the orbit of Earth enough that it wouldn't eliminate the possibility of microbial life, but it'd be a problem for advanced civilization. So it's crucial, in order for us to even have this class, that Mars be small. But this team in France was basically saying, there's got to be a solution to the small Mars problem. Now, it took them 20 years to solve the problem. About 30 papers were published where they got a step-by-step closer to it. But the final solution was that Jupiter and Saturn were engaged in what was called a grand tack movement. And what they meant is it moved towards the sun, stopped, changed direction, and went backwards. And because of that, it enabled Mars to be small. It basically disrupted the formation of Mars sufficiently, and we wound up with a small Mars instead of a huge Mars. It also eradicated the inner belt of the main belt of asteroids. So it explains why we don't have asteroids all the way to the orbit of Mars, but it stops about halfway between Jupiter and Mars. That too is a blessing for us human beings, because if we had asteroids all the way from Jupiter to Mars, we'd be getting a lot more bombardments from these asteroids than we otherwise do. We get a few, and we get just the right amount that we need. You don't want none, but you don't want a whole bunch either. Having an asteroid bash into the Earth every century or so would be bad news for civilization here on Earth. And so what this team discovered is that indeed, when you look at these extraplanetary solar systems, 80% of them, you notice that they have these gas giant planets orbiting closer than the Earth orbits the Earth. And this is because when they were forming, they were gravitationally interacting with the remnants, the leftover debris from planet formation, and that caused them to move towards the ice line and penetrate the ice line and get inside the orbit of Earth relative to their host star. And what that does, as I mentioned last week, is it really radically alters the orbits of the rocky planets. It explains why we see in these rocky planet systems these rocky planets with highly elliptical orbits. Remember the little geometry lesson I gave you on elliptical orbits last week? And if you have a highly elliptical orbit, that means you're far away from the host star in the wintertime, and you're really close during the summertime. Our seasons are dominated by the tilt of our rotation axis, but if you've got a highly elliptical orbit, your seasons are dominated by the shape of the orbit. And so, but what happened in the case of Jupiter and Saturn, they migrated inward. They began to exhaust all the debris and the planetesimals, which would stop the migration. But what the team in Nice discovered is it didn't just stop, it changed direction. And how did it change direction? Well, they determined that the density of these debris and planetesimals was greater at Saturn than it was at Jupiter. And that caused Saturn to move faster towards the Sun than Jupiter moved towards the Sun. And it got to a point where Saturn was making exactly two orbits about the Sun for every three orbits that Jupiter made. Again, if you remember Newton's laws of motion, the closer you are to the star, the faster you go around the star. So it explains why Mercury gets around the Sun every 3 months, whereas Earth takes 12 months to get around the Sun. Can you imagine how many birthdays you would have if you happened to be living on Mercury? Or how few birthdays you would get if you were living on Mars? Or really extreme, how few you would get if you were living on Neptune? You might make just three birthdays in the course of your lifetime. You'd be really old if you had three birthdays. Okay. But it was this moment when Saturn was making exactly two orbits around the Sun for every three orbits of Jupiter that caused the reversal. It's referred to as a mean motion resonance. And interesting dynamics happens when you got a mean motion resonance. And a mean motion resonance is basically you got two bodies orbiting a much more massive body where there's a small integer difference between the orbit of one body and the orbit of the other. You get the strongest mean motion effect when it's 1-2, where you've got a planet making exactly two orbits for every one orbit of the planet. Now, if that were the case for Jupiter and Saturn, the Grand Tack movement would have been so extreme it would have been a disaster for life in our solar system. The 2-3 is the second strongest mean motion resonance. And that mean motion resonance is exactly what we needed to get a planetary system that was fit for advanced life. And so this next slide here actually shows you where Jupiter changed direction. Saturn also changed direction. In fact, all the gas giant planets suffered a grand tack of movement, but Jupiter and Saturn experienced the most dramatic. But that little yellow line there shows you where Jupiter changed direction. And so it got to be a little bit beyond the orbit of Mars, where it changed direction. And that precise distance that it changed explains why we have a small Mars and not a big Mars. It also explains why we don't have any asteroids interior beyond that reversal point where Jupiter changed around. And yes, that ice line, it's about three times the distance of the Earth from the Sun. And so Jupiter and Saturn moved inward, Saturn at a more rapid rate, and then they changed direction and moved outward. And as they moved outward, they engage the small gas giant planets, Neptune and Uranus. And this next slide actually shows you in detail what happened to all four gas giants. And what you notice is, the y-axis there shows you the distance from the Sun. And so what it shows you is that we begin with Jupiter at about six times the distance from the Sun that the Earth is, Saturn at about nine. You got Neptune beginning at about 12, and Uranus beginning at about 16. But when Jupiter and Saturn basically reverse their migration from inward to outward, what you notice is you wind up with Jupiter basically returning virtually to where it began, a little bit interior. Right now, it's about 5.5 times the distance that Earth is from the Sun. It started off at about 6, so it's a little bit closer than where it started. And likewise with Saturn, it basically wound up where it started. But you also notice here is that Saturn had a much more dramatic change in movement. You see that sharp drop in distance, and that's what basically, along with Jupiter, explains how we get a small Mars and how we wind up having the main belt of asteroids stripped of half of its asteroids. What is really exceptional is what happened to Uranus and Neptune. Notice they basically changed places. Neptune starts off at 12 times the distance of the Sun from the Earth from the Sun, and where does it end up? At 30. So it gets a dramatic kick, and that kick is because of its close interaction with Jupiter and Saturn. What we see in the case of Uranus is that it didn't seem to move much at all. It started off at 16, it winds up at about 18. So it got a little bit of a bump and going outward, but Neptune flew by Uranus and went way out into the outer part of the solar system. And that dramatic kick of Neptune, where it goes 30 times the distance of the Sun, Earth from the Sun to where it is today, that had the effect of stripping down the outer asteroid belts. And we'll talk a little bit about the asteroid belts, but it was Neptune that basically reshaped the outer asteroid belts, and it was Jupiter and Saturn that reshaped the inner belt. We refer to the inner belt as the main belt. The irony of that is it's the smallest of the asteroid belts. We have five asteroid and comet belts. The smallest one is the main belt. But it was the first belt that was discovered because it was relatively close to the Earth. It was the easiest to find. But it was Neptune that basically reshaped those outer asteroid and comet belts to the degree we need for optimal advanced life on planet Earth. So, some of the benefits we get from this Grand Tack movement, and by the way, of all the exoplanetary systems we looked at, say, how many have we looked at so far? Over 3,000 planetary systems have been investigated. How many of them do we see a Grand Tack movement? Zero. None. Our solar system is the only one where we see that that has happened. But the inward migration eradicates the inner belt of the main belt of asteroids, which means we're not getting clobbered all the time. And if you have no migration at all, the belts, inner belts, remain intact. And we now have the telescope power to actually see comet and asteroid belts around other stars. And what we notice is 80% of them have no asteroids and comets at all. Those are the same systems where we see the gas giant planets orbiting close to their stars. And what the NEASE team was able to say, hey, if you got that dramatic of a migration where the gas giants come inside the orbit of the Earth about the Sun, it basically eradicates all the asteroid and comets. It either throws the asteroids and comets into the Sun or the star, or it takes them and blasts them out of the planetary system. And so for 80% of planetary systems, we don't see any asteroids or comets, but those are the same systems where the gas giants are orbiting in close. Now, for the other 20%, the asteroid and comet belts are 1,000 or more times bigger than the asteroid and comet belts in our solar system. And these are the same planetary systems where all the gas giant planets are orbiting beyond the gas giants in our planetary system. So kind of to show you what we see here is that 80% are over on the left where the gas giant planets are orbiting close and they have no asteroid and comets. And then the other 20% are like those over on the right where the gas giant planets are orbiting far away. And what we see is that they're loaded with asteroids and comets, thousands of times bigger than we see in our solar system. Our solar system is the exception, where we see the gas giant planets basically orbiting where they started off. They migrated inward, they migrated back to where they were, and you wind up with small asteroid and comet belts. So we are the only system that's got small asteroid and comet belts. And this basically shows you the asteroid and comet belts that we have, the main belt, which is halfway from Mars to Jupiter, out to Jupiter. And you do get a few that come in close. I mean, I keep having to answer a question on my social media pages, what's going to happen when Apophis shows up in 2026? And that's because at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, just a few miles away, it's the one institution where they're keeping track of the main belt of asteroids. And they've got this catalog of what they call main belt asteroids that have a possibility of orbiting near the Earth and maybe even colliding with the Earth. And so they're basically working on, okay, what is the risk factor? And so you can go to the Jet Propulsion site and they actually have a table there of all the asteroids that have the possibility of colliding with the Earth in the next 200 years. And they give them different risk factors. Well, several years ago, there was this asteroid called Apophis. And by the way, most of the asteroids are pretty tiny. This one was about 800 feet across, which isn't terribly big. And they were telling us it's going to hit the Earth in 2026. They didn't say that. They said it's got a possibility of hitting the Earth in 2026. And this got a lot of people asking me questions on social media. It's like, you know, do I need to build a bomb shelter? And do I need to take out insurance? And but what happened is 2 years ago, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory lowered the risk of Apophis hitting in 2026 to zero. And in the 2030s, also to zero. In fact, they lowered it to zero for any time in the next 100 years. But they did say, hey, if we're talking 300 years from now, maybe. We have a hard time determining these orbits because these bodies are small, which means they're easily disturbed by gravitational interactions by other bodies in the solar system. So they said, we cannot give you a guarantee 10,000 years into the future. We simply don't have the capacity to make those calculations. Not yet. They're looking for more funding from your U.S. taxpayers so they can actually be gauging all this. But I do think they're on to a point. We routinely insure ourselves against risks that are actually lower than the risk of an asteroid hitting the Earth. And so it's like it's worth our while to keep track of these asteroids. And NASA's demonstrated they've got the capability that they can determine, hey, this asteroid is going to collide with the Earth. They can send up a rocket that will nudge it away and prevent it from hitting the Earth. And so they're saying, hey, you know, this is actually worth some taxpayer investment because you really don't want an asteroid smashing into Manhattan. And so, and they actually say, hey, when it gets close enough, we could actually determine where it's going to hit in the Earth. But they've already done experiments with rockets where they've nudged asteroids and said, hey, we can nudge it away. Not that it's easy. It's really easy to nudge an asteroid in the direction you want if it's perfectly spherical. But these small asteroids are never perfectly spherical. And so it's always a little bit of a guess as to where that asteroid's going to go when you hit it. But these are the five belts. The main belt is the smallest of the five belts. The centaurs are between Jupiter and Neptune, and they have quite erratic orbits. You've got the scattered belt, which ranges from 2 billion to 20 billion miles from the sun. And to give you some idea of what that is, Neptune orbits at 3 billion miles from the sun. And the scattered belt, they have extremely elliptical orbits. The Kuiper belt, which is probably the belt that most people have heard of, if they've heard of a belt besides the main belt, that's a belt that's just beyond the orbit of Neptune and extends out to about 6 billion miles. And then the biggest belt of all is the Oort cloud, which extends from 10 billion miles away out to 2 trillion miles away. Almost, I mean, you know, that's a third of a light year. So the Oort belt really goes way out there. And we've now found comets, detected comets and asteroids in all five of these belts. You know, when I was first starting astronomy, we knew about the main belt. We knew about the centaurs, but we didn't know about the scattered, the Kuiper, the Oort cloud. Although it was Jan Oort, a Dutch astronomer, says there's got to be big asteroid and comet belts way beyond the orbit of Pluto. And so we actually predicted the structure of the Oort cloud before it was even discovered. And it turns out he was remarkably close to predicting the characteristics of the Oort cloud. And we're able to see Oort clouds around other stars. So almost every star has an Oort cloud around it. And these Oort clouds bump into one another because they extend out trillions of miles. When stars come close together, they wind up sharing or stealing comets and asteroids from one another. In fact, that probably explains the centaurs and the scattered belt, is because our star is more massive than most stars. I mean, there's only about 7% of the stars in our Milky Way galaxy that are more massive than our star, the Sun. So when our star, the Sun, gets close to another star, it usually gains asteroids and comets. If it's coming close to a star that's significantly less massive than it is, it winds up stealing comets and asteroids from the Oort cloud of that star. But they're going to have chaotic orbits. So that explains why we see the strange orbits of the centaurs and the scattered. They're probably stolen asteroids and comets from other planetary systems. Now, it turns out that these five asteroid and comet belts are precisely the right size and precisely the right distance from the Earth to ensure we get exactly the delivery of asteroids and comets that we need without getting so many that it basically makes our civilization impossible. Again, you don't want these things happening every century or so. But we do get a daily bombardment of asteroids and comets. Matter of fact, it was yesterday that we had a meteor shower. And usually the meteor shower in early January, you only get about 40 meteors an hour. This one came in at 120 meteors an hour. But hey, the moon was bright, so it couldn't have been that great. And I've seen a meteor shower. I saw one in 1966 where it was 6 per second, meteors coming in. That's the biggest one I've seen in my lifetime. But I think all of you have seen what you call a shooting star. And hey, if it comes close enough to you, it becomes a fireball. A fireball is usually defined as a meteor going through the atmosphere where it's close enough to you that it's bigger than a quarter of the diameter of the moon. And I've actually seen them 4 times the diameter of the moon. The ones you got to watch out for are the ones that get bigger and bigger and bigger and are not moving. That means it's heading right for you, and you'd better move quickly away. But people have actually seen shooting stars that have been fireballs, and actually seen it crash into the Earth, and they go there and they recover the meteorite, or several meteorites. That's what people often find, meteorites. But it turns out we get about 10,000 small comets colliding with the Earth every day. And that's a good thing. They're small, so they burn up in the atmosphere, so we really don't notice it. But comets are 85% frozen water. And so we get a small delivery of water on a daily basis from the comets. So most of these comets come from the outer asteroid belts. And so you go to the Kuiper belt, the Scatter belt, the Oort cloud, they're predominantly volatile objects, which means dominated by gases and liquids that are in a frozen state. Asteroids are rocky. So that's the difference between a comet and an asteroid. An asteroid is basically predominantly rock or metal. A comet is predominantly volatiles. We refer to comets as dirty snowballs. They're 85% frozen water. The other 15% is basically dirt. Carbonaceous materials, so carbon dioxide, carbon monoxide, ammonia, and all kinds of other stuff. And it has a little bit of rocky material in it. And so when a comet strikes the atmosphere, you will get some debris with that few percent. And the thing you notice, too, about comets is because they're mostly volatiles, when they hit the Earth's atmosphere, they typically splinter. So if you ever see a shooting star that becomes three or four different shooting stars, that's likely one of these mini comets that's gone through the atmosphere, and it hits the atmosphere, heats up, and begins to splinter. Whereas a rocky asteroid tends to be intact, especially a metal asteroid. Solid metal asteroids will not break up in the atmosphere. Some rocky ones will. And so the water we gain exactly balances the water we lose. Okay, because of the gravity of the Earth, we can hang on to carbon dioxide with great tenacity. We don't lose any carbon dioxide to interplanetary space. We don't lose the argon to interplanetary space. But we do lose a tiny amount of water. The escape velocity of water is just a little bit beyond what we see the gravitational pull of the Earth. So the Earth is able to hold on to almost all of its water, but a tiny amount of water does escape from the atmosphere on a daily basis. But the tiny amount that escapes is balanced by the tiny amount we gain from comets. You say, well, what about these asteroids that collide with the Earth? Well, what's interesting is that our moon orbits the Earth in such a way that it tends to scatter away from the Earth all the asteroids, or many of the asteroids, that are of light composition. So it tends to scatter away the rocky ones, and it tends to funnel in the heavy metal asteroids. About 20 to 25% of the asteroids in the main belt are what we call metal asteroids. They're made of alloys of metals, and typically metals that are heavier than iron. In fact, NASA has got their eyes on an asteroid in the main belt that they value at about $50 quadrillion. That's because of how loaded it is with gold and platinum and osmium, all the stuff that we recognize as being very valuable. There's even some thoughts about, hey, that big one would be hard to grab, but maybe we can find a smaller one that'd be less expensive to grab, and we can bring it into a lunar orbit. We don't want to put it on an Earth orbit, because you put it on an Earth orbit, there's a possibility it will gravitationally collapse and hit the Earth. I said, let's put it in a lunar orbit. Leave it in a lunar orbit, and we can mine this thing and make a lot of money and actually pay for the NASA budget, right? We can relieve the taxpayer of that financial responsibility. So that's actually being seriously considered. However, we already know that some asteroids like that have hit the Earth. And there's one outside of Johannesburg in South Africa where an asteroid hit there, and it was big enough that it punctured the crust of the Earth and caused some valuable metal material in the mantle of the Earth to come to the surface of the Earth to complement the stuff that was in that particular asteroid. This happened about 250 million years ago, but that one asteroid collision is responsible for more than 80% of the gold that's in circulation in our economy, and more than 90% of the platinum that's in circulation in our economy. So we are blessed by this asteroid that struck the Earth. And hey, what would life be like if we didn't have all that gold and osmium and platinum? There's also another asteroid that struck in Ontario, Canada, north shore of Lake Huron, near a city called Sudbury. And Sudbury is a city of over 100,000 people, and the city thrives on that one asteroid. Again, it's an asteroid that hit a little less than 200 million years ago, but 50% of the nickel that's in circulation comes from that one asteroid. And if you ever visit Sudbury, Ontario, as you come to the outskirts of the city, they got this gigantic Canadian nickel, measures about 30 feet across, and basically letting you know, hey, this is where all your nickel comes from. And it's basically a stainless steel asteroid. And again, about 20% of all the asteroids that hit the Earth are stainless steel asteroids. asteroids that are actually a better grade of stainless steel than you can typically purchase from a steel manufacturer. These are asteroids that are 100% made up of iron, nickel, and cobalt, but the nickel and cobalt quantity is so great, you get a very high grade of stainless steel. Well, such an asteroid hit there outside of Sudbury, Canada, and they've been mining that, and we've all been blessed for the nickel that's come from that. And have you ever read Genesis chapter 4, where it talks about how even before Noah's flood, you had Tubal Cain engage in metallurgy? And a lot of people have said, there's no way that could be true. How could humans living thousands of years ago, tens of thousands of years ago, be engaged in advanced metallurgy? Well, they now know that the Inuit, the native peoples of northern Canada and Greenland, what they would do when the snow was falling is that they would get on their dog sleds and go around, and they would look for these black rocks that would fall on the snow and the ice, recognizing that these were meteorites, and they would be harvesting the stainless steel meteorites and cold forging them into advanced tools. And so the idea that metallurgy is a recent phenomenon, I mean, I was taught in elementary school, hey, we begin with a copper age, and then we go to a lead age, then a bronze age, and an iron age. Well, it turns out that the first age of metallurgy was actually iron, and it was people gathering up these stainless steel meteorites and cold forging them into tools. And so we now know that metallurgy goes way back, and this was a real help to the people living between Adam's time and Noah's time and the generations thereafter being able to take advantage by these asteroids. So once again, we're getting just the right delivery. Now, because we're deeping back into the last ice age, it's a bit challenging to find the evidence for metallurgy. Again, I've been engaged in debates with theologians and scientists saying, Genesis 4 has got to be wrong. There's no way we could have advanced metallurgy that early. And like we don't see until the Neolithic Revolution, but we don't see a lot of things to the Neolithic Revolution. The Neolithic Revolution, 11, 12,000 years ago, is when the human population began to expand, began to grow rapidly, and it's also a time when people began to form complex social structures. That's the first time you see villages and towns and cities. It's the first time you see people trading. It's the first time you see different towns and cities specializing, where one village would say, all we're going to do is make pottery. We're not going to grow crops. We're only going to make pottery. We're only going to make certain tools. And we'll trade our excess pottery with other villages for their food, for their meat or whatever. And so you get people specializing. This is where you see food production going up and begin to see sophisticated manufacture going up. It's all because the Ice Age ended. With the end of the last Ice Age, you got climate stability for the first time. This is what enables people to begin to specialize, develop trade routes, the population grows, which means it makes it really easy to find human artifacts. But if you're in the last Ice Age, what you've got is extreme climate instability. The population is low, and people are not specializing. They're basically having to do everything for themselves. And so we'd anticipate it's going to be challenging to find the artifacts. And it's only in the last decade that they've found any artifacts at all. Some of these artifacts have been these tools that people made out of these iron meteorites. But the other thing that we have found is that they were engaged in sophisticated agriculture and food preparation. And good thing, because we human beings are not designed to eat the food that the Neanderthals were eating. The Neanderthals had very powerful jaws and big teeth, so they could take and harvest just wild plants in the environment, and they could actually chew that stuff and consume it. Mind you, it took them about 4 or 5 hours to consume the food for the day, because they were eating, you know, very coarse food that was hard to chew, and had to use up a lot of energy to eat that food. You know, as much as 20% of their daily energy was basically spent chewing their food. Can you imagine what that would be for you if you had to spend, you know, say a 20% of your daily caloric just basically chewing your food, and chewing your food for 4 to 5 to 6 hours? Well, we humans have, you know, we only got how many teeth? 32 teeth that are not big, and we don't have powerful jaws, but our jaws and our face and our teeth, our tongue and everything, it's well designed for eating soft food. So we can very efficiently eat soft food, but it means we need to have soft food. So how did early humans get soft? Well, they quickly figured out we can't eat like those Neanderthals eat. We can't eat like the great apes can eat. We don't have the muscle and the jaw structure to make that work. We got to find some way to make our food soft. And they quickly figured out, okay, we harvest these grains, we harvest these plants, and what we're going to do is we're going to roast them. So they'd roast them over a fire, then they grind them up with their stone tools, then they would boil them and mash them and cook them again, and now they got soft food to eat. This basically shows that the first humans must have been able to immediately develop the technology to process their food, because if they couldn't process their food, they couldn't have survived. We simply don't have the anatomy to keep ourselves alive on coarse food that's raw, that we simply pick from the wild. I mean, you can get a little bit from the wild. You can pick what wild blueberries and raspberries. But have you ever tried to keep your body alive just on the wild fruit that you pick? I remember hiking once in Hawaii along the Naupali Trail in Kauai, and there was a guy we got to meet there, and he said, "Look, this trail is filled with fruit. I don't have to pack any food. There's mangoes everywhere, there's guava everywhere, there's mountain apple, and there's huge abundance. You can pick as much as you want." But after a couple of days, you figure there's no way you can eat enough of that stuff to be able to keep hiking. So he said, after 2 days, "I got to get out of here. I got to find some way to get some protein, some fat. You know, these carbohydrates from fruit, it just isn't doing the job." I said, "Well, it would work if you just kind of took a nap all day. But if you want to hike around, no, you need more food than that." So, but we now have, archaeologists have found, and this was first discovered in Turkey, where they found charred food remains that date to be at least 40,000 years old, that show the evidence that the humans at that time were harvesting grains. And they actually found quite a range of sophisticated grains. They found peas, they found pistachios, they found various mustard seeds and peppers. So it says they obviously like to spice their food. So it means that they were quite sophisticated, so they had to be actually planting the food, doing some purposeful agriculture in order to get the quantity of grains that they would need, especially to get the spices that they had there. And that they were taking all these food products and roasting them, grinding them, boiling them, mashing them, cooking them again, and therefore, and they actually found that they had cooking hearths. They had sophisticated hearths that they were using to do their roasting and cooking. So the earliest humans they knew what to do. And it actually shows you why humans very quickly displaced the Neanderthals, because we were able to come up with an abundance of food, and instead of spending 5 or 6 hours chewing our food, we spend a few minutes chewing our food. And the food is so soft and so enjoyable, we can even have conversations with one another as we chew and eat our food. Have you ever watched orangutans or apes or chimpanzees eating food? They don't socialize while they're eating food. They have to expend so much energy in eating their food. They're basically isolated from the rest. They socialize after they eat their food. We humans are different. We socialize while we're eating our food. Matter of fact, we tend to do more socializing when we're eating our food than when we're not eating our food. It's unique to human beings. You don't see it in any other species. And it's because we have the brain capability to be able to develop the technology to process our food. And what really was interesting in that discovery that they found in Turkey, and they've now found it in Greece as well, that people living 40,000 years ago or even earlier, what they were doing was harvesting poisonous foods that no other animal could eat. And we would process the foods to make them non-poisonous. One example would be the whole family of vetches. Probably none of you have ever eaten vetches, but they're very abundant in the Middle East and in Southern Europe. And early humans figured out, hey, this stuff is very abundant, no one else is eating it. Let's grab it and see if we can process it in such a way that we can turn it into a food product. And they did. They found out, hey, you know, if we roast it and grind it and boil it to death, we can eat it, and it's easy to eat. It doesn't taste good, but this is why we see so many mustard seeds and pepper seeds in these ancient remains. They basically used other seeds as a way to bring flavor to these otherwise nasty-tasting vegetables that they're eating. So, hey, I got a little off topic here. So, and I also didn't look at the time. Well, I'm going to stop here, but when I get to you 3 weeks from today, I will talk about this incredible planet that we have. And we all know we live in a beautiful planet. We all have photographs of beautiful places we've been and visited. But I'm going to talk to you about some of the provision and beauty of our planet that most people don't even think about. In fact, I have rarity even see it in the scientific literature. So with that, let's stop, and I'll take questions as usual. We'll alternate between questions from people that are here in person and those that are participating online.
Hi, you. I just wanted you to comment on a news article that I actually heard on the radio, that there are space corporations that are going to land on the moon sometime in February, and they're competing against each other of who can land there first, and their objective is to be a base to go from there to Mars. And what are the implications of that? And I don't know anything else about it.
Yeah, good point. And yes, not private corporations, but there are governments that are actually thinking seriously about trying to establish a colony on the moon. And what gives us some validity is the fact that they have found a deep crater at the south pole of the moon where the walls of the crater are so high that the sun never shines on the floor of the crater. You know, we're just talking about comets. You know, comets not only strike the Earth, they strike the moon, they strike Mars. In fact, you ever wonder why the ice caps on Mars are so small? I mean, Earth has got a bigger ice cap than Mars has. And you would expect, hey, it's more distant from the sun. Mars should have a really big cap. But Mars' rotation axis tilt goes back and forth by 60 degrees. And so it'll form an ice cap, but when the rotation axis tilts over, the ice cap basically evaporates to outer space and a new one's got to form. Well, a new one forms from comets. Well, at the south pole of the moon, there's a small crater with very high walls, and the bottom floor, there's frozen water. The frozen water is basically the residue of comets. These are comets that have struck them. Typically in the moon, when a comet strikes, the frozen water evaporates and dissipates to interplanetary space. But if the sun never shines on the floor of a crater, then neither will that ice ever evaporate. It'll remain in a frozen state. And so a number of governments in the world are saying, hey, we can tap into that water. We can set up a base near that crater, and the water we can drink, and we can break the water up. That will give us oxygen we can breathe and hydrogen we can use as a fuel. You know, so that solves three major problems of a colony. You're going to need water for the people to drink. You're going to need oxygen for them to breathe, and you're going to need a fuel for them to have an energy source. So, hey, that takes care of it all. And people in the same, once we get a base established near that South Pole, maybe we can get a set up enough infrastructure that we can actually use that as a place to get to Mars. And the rationale there is it's a lot easier to get a rocket to go from the moon to Mars than it is from Earth to Mars. Because in the case of the moon, you only got 1/6 the gravity, so you don't have to spend as much money with rocket fuel or a big rocket to get off the moon as you would off the Earth. Now, there's the logistical issues, right? That means you got to build a really sophisticated base on the moon for that even to be conceivable. My personal opinion is it's not worth the money. It's far better to go to Mars with the machines if your goal is science. If your goal is to say, hey, let's learn more about the solar system, let's go to Mars and see if we can learn something we don't already know. As I've said before in this class, we're no longer in the 1970s. In the 1970s, there was a rationale for sending people to the moon because people could do things machines could not do. Today, it's the opposite. Machines can do way more than what people can do. They can do it in less time. So the idea was, well, people will save time because once they're there, they can say, hey, this didn't work. We can do this instead. They're already there. Well, the truth is, we now have the technology where the machines can do not only do it better, they can do it faster. And nobody dies when you send a machine. So you have no risk of having to worry about the health of the human participants. So in many respects, all that money that's being spent at NASA Houston, I mean, NASA's got five major facilities. Houston is the center for manned space travel. And there's a rationale for that in the 1970s. My personal opinion is that rationale is gone, if your goal is science. However, what gets the taxpayers excited are manned space flights. And everybody, I mean, I remember back in 1969, virtually the entire North American population was glued to their TV set watching Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin walk around on the moon. It was a huge, I mean, it was a wonderful thing to see and experience. It's a little bit different to try to capture a big TV audience for a machine crawling around on the moon. You know, yeah, people are going to say, forget about that. So, or a machine crawling around Mars. Although I must admit, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory does an excellent job of getting the public excited about the different machines that are moving around on Mars. And it's not just these rovers, they actually have helicopters that are now hovering over Mars and taking photographs. If you've never visited the Jet Propulsion site, it's worth a visit to see the amazing things that they're able to do with machines on Mars. And NASA's now actually seriously thinking about, let's go to Europa, a moon that's orbiting Jupiter, a moon that we know is 35% water. And they said it's possible Europa is orbiting close enough to Jupiter that the gravitational energy or force from Jupiter is sufficient to heat the water inside and turn it from ice to liquid. And if there's liquid water, maybe there's microbes running around there. I don't think there's any possibility of that. I wrote about that in Origins of Life. But NASA's actually seriously thinking, let's use the people of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. We'll send a mission to Europa. We'll land a machine on the surface of Europa. It'll drill through 26 miles of ice that we know must be there, and hopefully there's liquid water underneath that. And once we drill a hole through there, we can drop a small machine down that will swim around with a camera and look for what's existing there in that slushy stuff underneath the 26 miles. Now, I've spoken to people at NASA saying, I think it'd be wise to first send an orbiter around Europa. An orbiter around Europa will tell you whether or not there's actual liquid water below the surface of Europa. If it's frozen all the way through, that's going to be a big disappointment, right? But if we know there's liquid water there, and for just a couple of million dollars, we can send a spaceship to Europa, orbit around it, and determine whether or not there's any water, how deep it is, how much thickness of ice you got to get through, because the other project is $2 billion. So for the interest of the taxpayer, I think it's worth a $2 million investment to see if it's worthwhile going there for $2 billion. People have been talking about it, but I'll also say to this, if people ask you to sign up for a one-way mission to Mars, and it will be a one-way mission, they're not going to be able to get you back, I would still turn them down. So, although there is a list that you can sign your friends up for a mission to Mars. So if you got someone you don't like, you can volunteer them to go on a mission to Mars. And it's one thing to keep people alive on the moon for a few days. It's another matter to keep people alive on a trip to Mars and back that's going to take several years. I'm on record as saying the machines, we can get them there safely. We can even bring them back safely. People is another matter. NASA yet does not have any plan to figure out how to get people to Mars there and back without them dying in the process. So I'll stop there. I could talk more. Go ahead.
I want to remind everybody there's a lot of good treats over here on the table, so help yourselves.
Really good treats, too.
Yeah. Online, David Seary, can you explain how the Euclid Space Telescope mission will complement the James Webb Space Telescope mission to explain the nature of dark energy and dark matter?
Yes. The European Space Agency has sent a big telescope at the L2 Lagrange point where the James Webb Space Telescope has been there for almost 2 years. And so it's the second telescope at that site, but it has a different design and a different mission. The Euclid telescope is basically designed to map millions of galaxies in the universe, galaxies and galaxy clusters. And its goal is to come up with such an extensive map that they'll be able to determine the nature of dark energy and dark matter. And so they're basically looking at what are called acoustic oscillations, gravitational ripples that we see as a result of the cosmic creation event. And by looking at the distribution of galaxies and galaxy clusters, they can actually map those ripples, and the maps of those ripples will give us insight on the nature of both dark energy and dark matter, which together make up 95% of all the stuff of the universe. So, whereas James Webb, his goal is to try to figure out what's happening in the history of the universe, and particularly what insights can we gain about the first stars that form in the universe and the first galaxies. That's its main mission. It's got subsidiary missions, like to be able to determine the atmospheric constituents of these planets that we're finding orbiting other stars, and see if any of them have atmospheres that are somewhat comparable to the atmospheres we see on the planets in our solar system. Dave.
Hugh, my question actually is the slide that you have. In the past, you've shared that one of the reasons that we have circular orbits and thus advanced life is because we have the asteroid belt gives us our circular orbits, which is so critical for advanced life. And you've shared in the past that when we look at other solar systems, we either find no asteroid belt at all, which means, of course, they don't have circular orbits, or we find like one big, huge asteroid belt, you know, where the sun looks like a fuzzy ball because it's got so many stuff floating around it. And so the question, obviously, is do we have any idea why these other solar systems either have no asteroid belt or one huge one? And why is our solar system so unique in having these asteroid belts that no other solar system has?
Okay, yeah, let me review what we had here just a few minutes ago, is that if you got extrasolar planetary systems where the gas giant planets migrate inside the orbit of the Earth relative to the Sun, that migration basically eradicates all the asteroids and comets. And that's true of 80% of the planetary systems we see, is that they have no asteroid and comet belts, but they're the same systems where their gas giant planets have migrated a considerable distance towards their host stars. Whereas where you see these stars that have these enormous asteroid and comet belts, it's where their gas giants have not migrated at all or have migrated outward. And therefore, the asteroid and comet belts have been preserved. The exception is our solar system, where the gas giant planets moved inward, stopped, changed direction, and moved outward. And that was all because of that 2-3 mean motion resonance of Jupiter and Saturn. So that explains why we alone have small asteroid and comet belts, as opposed to no asteroids and comets, or having asteroid and comet belts that are thousands of times bigger, and therefore with intense bombardments.
Dr. Ross, I have a, where you talked about, you got off topic. So a couple of questions about early man from RTB's model, and then your understanding theologically of God's relationship with early man. So you mentioned that men displaced Neanderthals. Can you clarify, first off, when did Homo sapiens sapiens originate? When did God create Adam and Eve? Secondly, when, if any, did the interaction with Neanderthals occur?
A couple of good questions, and they are in my latest book, Rescuing Inerrancy. There's a whole chapter there that addresses those questions. So I'll try to be brief. We don't know for sure if humans and Neanderthals met one another. We got Neanderthals going extinct about 45,000 years ago. Humans are coming into Neanderthal territory about 45,000 years ago. So they may have met one another, but it's also possible that what drove the Neanderthals to extinction was the fact that the climate was changing at such a radical degree. Because of 45,000 years ago, you got the global mean temperature jumping up and down by 8 degrees centigrade on a rapid basis. So there's some scientists thinking that it wasn't humans that basically outcompeted the Neanderthals. It may have been a climate disaster that caused them to go extinct. And we know that their population was never very large. The maximum population that anthropologists will cite for Neanderthals is around 15,000 individuals worldwide, which means and explains why the Neanderthals' DNA is so highly inbred. There simply wasn't very many of them around, and we got 15,000 over, say, 8 million square miles, that means you'd have an extremely low population density. Whereas humans evidently had enough numbers that we weren't suffering from the inbreeding crisis. So they might have had an inbreeding crisis that led to their extinction. It may have been a climate disaster, or they may have been outcompeted by human beings. And the outcompeted by human beings is the most favorable model in the scientific literature. And I gave reasons why humans obviously would have outcompeted Neanderthals. We have the anatomical and the brain structure to be able to process food and therefore make it much more efficient to eat our food. What's interesting is we need more calories than the Neanderthals, in spite of the fact that the Neanderthals are bigger than we are. And so because of the way we're anatomically designed, we need a lot of energy. But the thing is, we humans are able to gather calories far more efficiently than any of the great apes or any of the bipedal primates. They had to spend a lot of energy getting their food. We had to spend a lot less. And because we could process our food, we didn't have to spend a lot of energy consuming it either. So in terms of a date for when humans originated, the Bible gives you a rough date. It basically says that God created Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, a place where four rivers come close together. It names the rivers. We can easily identify those rivers Two of them are flowing today, the Tigris and the Euphrates. Two have stopped flowing with the close of the last ice age. That would be the Gihon and the Pishon. But those four rivers come together in a location that's now 200 feet below sea level. During that last ice age, they would have been above sea level. So what we've written in our books is that God created Adam and Eve sometime during an ice age, most likely the last ice age. And we're talking the last ice age, that gives you a date for God creating Adam and Eve of about 14,000 to 125,000 years ago. We can scientifically push that date back because the evidence I was giving you for humans processing their food and building these structures so that they can process their food, that goes back at least 40,000 years ago. That's carbon-14 dating, which is a reliable dating technique. So that would be 40,000 to say 125,000 years ago. Now, if you read the scientific literature, they give you a date for the origin of anatomically modern humans of 150,000 years ago, plus or minus 150,000 years. And that's because once you get earlier than about 40, 45,000 years ago, we have no radiometric dating tools. You do pick up one at about 250,000 years ago or 300,000 years ago, but between that date and 40,000 years ago, we have no radiometric dating tool. All we have are indirect dating methods, things like thermoluminescence, optical luminescence, you've got electron spin resonance. These all have huge systematic effects. I mean, for example, with optical luminescence, you're basically determining how long your sample has been isolated from sunlight. But you're presuming that there's been no exposure of that sample after it's been buried. I mean, a bear may have dug it up and re-exposed it, which means you got some unknown factors there, which explains why they say it's 150,000 years ago, plus or minus 150,000 years. To give you one extreme example, in the scientific literature they were saying, we got proof that Aborigines had been in Australia for 60,000 years, because at the Jimnian rock site, they were able to use both optical and thermoluminescence to determine that human artifacts were 60,000 years old. But several years later, they found some carbon in those artifacts and were able to do carbon-14 dating. The carbon-14 date came back 3,000 years ago, showing that the optical luminescence and thermoluminescence dates were wrong by a factor of 20 times. So you actually get a more accurate date from the Bible than you get from the scientific dating tools.
If I understand that correctly, 100,000 years ago would be acceptable and compatible with RTB's model?
100,000 years ago would be acceptable. I would say 300,000 years ago would be unacceptable.
Right. Was there an ice age coincidence at that time frame?
Well, when you get back to about 125,000 years ago, you've got another interglacial where the planet becomes warm, but it's not like our interglacial. Our interglacial is a long period of warm, stable climate. The previous interglacial was predominantly warm, but there was significant cold incidence as well. Then previous to that, there was another 90,000-year-long ice age. And so I can't give you an exact date, is the bottom line. But we can discern from the Bible that Adam and Eve must have been created during an ice age. We can also go to Genesis 6 and 7 and 8 and discern that Noah's flood also must have occurred during an ice age.
Okay, great, thank you. And my last question was related to the reference to them learning how to cook food. I'm talking about humans. Learning how to cook food and doing metallurgy and stuff. The Bible gives us reference to his interaction with us after we fell. And that he had kicked us out of the garden, and then he clothed us with these skins. This is just purely supposition or theological inference. In your opinion, how much of what we learned, because as you mentioned, we immediately apparently were able to cook food. How much did we learn from Jesus when, after he had kicked us out of the garden? Surely he didn't just completely abandon us. The Bible makes it clear that he didn't. And how much, in your opinion, this is, again, hypothetical, how long did he, like, interact closely with Adam and Eve to kind of give them, show them the ropes, you know, teach them how to survive?
Well, I think there's some of that going on, because it does tell us in Genesis 3 that God used animal skins to make clothes for Adam and Eve, and probably showed them, hey, this is how you can do it for yourself. And so, for example, there's evidence that early humans were using the furs of rodents to make clothes. And, you know, I got relatives in Canada. Often what they do is they'll get a bunch of these, rabbits that have this nice thick white fur in the wintertime, these snowshoe hares. And if you harvest, say, a dozen of those, you can make yourself a nice fur coat. So with sleeves and everything. What we do know is that humans were inhabiting regions of the earth that were 15 degrees Fahrenheit colder than what a Neanderthal could tolerate. And that's amazing, because Neanderthals are anatomically designed for a really cold climate. We're not designed for a cold climate at all. We freeze in a cold climate. I mean, in fact, I've noticed coming, I came from Canada to Southern California. What shocked me coming to Southern California, people wear coats when it's 60 degrees outside, and sweaters. It's like, we didn't put a sweater on until it was freezing. I'm like, hey, you know, it's not 50 below anymore. It's actually warm outside. So we go outside in our t-shirts at 25 above to enjoy the sunlight. Not for very long, mind you. We go back inside fairly quickly. So, but what they now know is that humans were basically, had a clothing, just like we were eating soft food almost immediately, we had to be wearing clothes almost immediately because of how humans were moving into these cold climate zones. Now, I've been asked a question. Well, what about Adam and Eve? They were naked. How did they fare? Because after all, they got bodies like us that just aren't going to function in a cold climate. Well, what a lot of people don't realize is that the Persian Gulf region, that's the warmest sea in the entire world. There's no place warmer than the Persian Gulf region. And so they could do fine without wearing clothes. In fact, wearing clothes would have been a major problem for them. And what we see in Genesis 3 is that God made clothes for them to hide their genital organs. So I don't think he was making very big fur coats for them, because the Persian Gulf area would be too hot for that. But we quickly notice humans moving into Siberia and northern Europe. What's interesting is that I'm writing a book on Noah's flood right now, and how what I found interesting is that the first humans in southern Europe arrived at the same time as the first humans in northern Europe. For that to be feasible, they had to have sophisticated clothing technology to be able to inhabit all of Europe at about the same time. Okay, next question.
Well, here's one from Doug. He asks, how were the tectonic plates of the Earth formed before the moon-forming collision event?
Well, before the moon-forming collision event, Earth did not have tectonic plates. The planet was too hot. I mean, that tectonic plates, the planet has to cool enough where you get a crust that's solid. And so before that, that was not the case. And the moon-forming event basically heated up the entire planet. So it was significantly after the moon-forming event where the Earth had cooled enough where it could get a crust. Same thing would have been true of the moon. The moon would have started off as a molten mass, but as it cooled, it would have formed a crust. And there's a debate out whether or not the moon ever had plate tectonic activity. Most people think it never did. And so it probably had plates, But if the plates are locked together, that's what we call a rigid plate body. Means it got plates, but the plates can't move relative to one another.
This will probably be our last question. We're going over a little for you because you'll be gone. This is from Tenny W. She says, hi, Dr. Ross. Genesis 6:13 states, "And God said to Noah, I have determined to make an end of all flesh, for the earth is filled with violence through them. Behold, I will destroy them with the earth." So, and then she goes on. Does that mean all life outside of the ark was destroyed? If so, how is that reconciled with the worldwide but localized floods?
Good question. I'm actually hoping to finish up this book on Noah's flood, the first draft at least this week. I got a chapter to go, so I'm going to try to get some of that done this afternoon. To answer that particular question, yes, according to Genesis, Noah's flood wiped out all human beings except for the eight individuals on board the ark. A lot of people think it also says it wiped all the land animals. There's actually eight different words in the original Hebrew for the animals wiped out by Noah's ark. And it's referring to the soulish animals that were in relationship with human beings. So these would be the birds and mammals that were domesticated by humans, or they were being part of some kind of farm system or pet system. As it tells us in the book of Leviticus, it's only those animals that can be damaged by human sin. If you got a bird or a mammal that has little or no contact with human beings, the behavior of that animal is undisturbed. But if that animal is owned by an individual who is incredibly wicked in their behavior, that wicked behavior will affect the behavior of the animal, which is why God says not only must the humans be destroyed, but their animals as well. It's their animals, it's not the animals that they don't own. And so I don't think there are any kangaroos on board the ark, because I don't think humans had any contact with kangaroos. Likewise, no penguins on board the ark, no polar bears on board the ark, because humans had no contact with those creatures, which means those creatures would not have been damaged by human reprobate behavior. So there's no need for God to eradicate them. It's the same principle you see when the children of Israel go into the land of Canaan, and they begin to conquer the cities of the Canaanites. Notice in some cities, God says, you must kill all the people, men, women, and children, but you can keep the animals. Other places, he says, you also got to destroy the animals. The animals have been contaminated by the sin of the people who lived there. In some places, you can't even touch their personal possessions. That's contaminated too. And so what we see in the context of Noah's flood is the people at that time were so ubiquitously wicked that all of their animals, their pets and their domesticated animals, had been tainted by the reprobate behavior. It's something that you see in the book of Leviticus. Notice in the book of Leviticus, it talks about what happens if you have a cow that's goring other animals and people and injuring them. The text says the owner of the cow is to be rebuked. And if the cow continues in that behavior, the cow is to be killed and the owner is to be killed along with the cow. Basically saying the reason why the animal is behaving that way, it's not the animal's fault, it's the owner's fault. Which is why God says in Jericho, the animals have to be killed. And that's why God said to Noah, hey, it'll be the animals, but only the animals, the soulish animals that are in possession of the wicked people. So no polar bears had to be on the ark. No kangaroos had to be on the ark. No wombats on the ark. And no American turkeys had to be in the ark either. Because